Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
We open the show tonight with a classic martini in hand because we're about to delve into the world of gin. Last week we travelled to Russia. We enjoyed our neat glass of vodka with pickles and bread. Before that, we were on an international adventure with ramen pirates. So now we've arrived at gin. So I want to know, how do you take your gin? Do you enjoy the easiest cocktail on earth, a gin and tonic, a twist of lime? Some say you should never use lime, that you should only use lemon. Where do you stand on that? 1-300-800-222 or the SMS 0467-922-702. It's a spirit with a fascinating history. Did you know it originated as a medicinal liqueur made by monks? That it may have helped ward off plague in the 14th century, but then its reputation took a real beating in the 18th century when it was considered the root of all evil and given the name Mother's Ruin. Well, that has changed. The gin industry is thriving here in Australia. They reckon there are over 1,000 gins being made here today. 1,000. So how did a once medicinal liqueur, once considered the root of all evil, become one of the most sought-after spirits at an Aussie bar? Well, David Box is the man to tell you. He is the author of the book Australian Gin. He's the founder of Gin Tonica, the one-stop shop for everything Australian gin. He even calls himself the gin envoy of the Australian distilling movement. David, hello. Safe to say you're a fan of gin.
I'd say that, Suzanne. Just a little.
So have you got it one in hand with you tonight?
I do. In fact, I've needed a little bit of gin after spending 8 hours at the Melbourne Gin Festival today talking gin all day. So because I've been talking it, I needed to taste some at the end of the day.
Of course you did. So you talked gin all day, you had to taste some. Now you're talking gin again, and you've got, how have you having it?
Well, actually, I couldn't find a fresh lemon. I don't know what happened there, but I do have some dehydrated lime. So it's always a good standby because I can't think of how many hundreds of dollars I've spent buying limes, just watching them get mouldy in the fridge.
So you're obviously not a proponent of the idea that it should always be lemon, not lime.
No, garnish is a subject we could spend an hour on, Suzanne, because the real trick with gins is if it's a good gin, why not drink it straight or with ice? Really good gins. Otherwise, really, it's a matter of taste. You can put a garnish in that goes with the gin or complements the gin. So it's all about what you use for what gin. And most distillers' websites, they'll actually suggest what you use.
Okay. Now, where did your passion for gin begin, David?
Oh, I lived in the London in the 90s and I got used to the 6 o'clock ritual. And very good friends of mine there used to roll out the drinks cart at 5:55, get everything ready. You'd nearly have a countdown on it. And really started with Bombay Sapphire.
So why do Australians love their gin so much now? I mean, I just said there's something like 1,000 Aussie gins being made. Are Australians among the people in the world who are embracing it the most now?
That's a very good question. I actually had a thought about it today, and looking at the distillers who are around the festival today, I think there's probably more like 1,500, to be honest. I did a count not long ago, and I think I've, with judging and a few other things, I've probably tried 800 different Aussie gins. And so it's quite amazing. Where the love of gin came from, I think it's the fact that for so long, we haven't had a small craft spirits business in this country. And it wasn't until the 90s that all changed.
No, we will get to that part of gin's history as well. I've got David Box with me, author of Australian Gin, founder of Gin Tonica. If you have any questions about gin, David is your man. 1-300-800-222 or 0467 922 702. So let's just be clear, what is gin exactly and how is it made?
I'm going to make some friends of mine very unhappy, but actually you could call it flavoured vodka. That's a bit of a sin, but it's made basically from neutral grain spirit, which is pretty much what vodka is. And you can flavour vodka, you can put flavourings in there. But the difference with a gin is that it's distilled with what they call botanicals. So these are plant or spices. But the key thing, Suzanne, is juniper. That's what makes gin, gin.
Okay. So you can put anything else you like with it, as long as it's got the juniper, it's gin.
That's pretty much it. It's got to have a flavour of juniper. So there's a lot of gins today, and the passion people have for gins can be for a gin that might be very sweet. And some of them, like a Christmas gin, there's hard to find any piney flavour of juniper in there.
All right. So different from vodka in that it's got the juniper as well. All right.
Yep.
Now, I understand, David, there are monks involved in this story. Do we really have them to thank for the G&T?
Well, like champagne, I think. These guys, didn't have a lot to do. I think it might have been the Benedictine monks as well there. But, it all started in Italy in Salerno, and I think that's where the first records come from. And this is way back at the beginning of making agua vita, which was considered to be alcohol. So they infused it with juniper berries, which by that stage were already considered to have medicinal properties.
Now, presumably the juniper berries were what they could find locally in Salerno then, which is how gin came to have juniper.
Well, the good thing about juniper is it's one of the most common bushes around the world.
Oh, is it?
So, yeah, and for that reason, it's been picked up by a lot of people. If there was juniper in Australia, it'd be a First Nations bush tucker.
Yeah. So what kind of conditions does juniper need to grow? I don't think I've ever seen a juniper bush. I wouldn't know one if I fell over one.
There are different sources around, Suzanne. One of the ones that's used quite often is Macedonian juniper, but they're real spiky, horrible things. And there are different types of varieties of juniper. Some would be grown in people's gardens. There's a mountain juniper with purple berries. But no, they're a terribly spiky plant and they don't really all ripen at once. So the one thing you need is a lot of people who are willing to reach in and pick the little buggers.
So are we growing a lot of it here now, or does it get imported for people who are making their gin?
It's mostly imported. Gin's taken off, there are a lot of places starting to grow juniper. I'm not sure how much money they're going to make, considering how much it would cost to pay people to pick them. We're leaving oranges on trees. So, but it's interesting to use fresh juniper berries rather than semi-dry.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, so that's the juniper berry and how that came to be added in. And obviously the monks were quite happy to reach into the prickly plant. Maybe they didn't have a lot to do, as you suggested. So did it really help ward off the plague in the 14th century?
Oh, there's so many stories about juniper, but yes, there was the whole point, if you think about juniper having a very piney flavour, you've got, I wouldn't make a direct comparison, you've got pinocline today. it has properties that are what you call biocidal, and people thought even just the lovely fresh smell of pine is something that people felt, and I think it's pretty much proven now that it was able to ward off and actually be a bit protective against catching the plague.
So biocidal, what does that mean exactly?
Oh, killing nasty things. It's like it's like the alcohol for hand wash. That's one of the good reasons why spirits exist.
Right. Wow. So that's not the pinocline reference there. And so I understand people even like will mask stuff with juniper berries in the hopes of warding off the deadly disease.
That's right. It probably smelt better than the streets at that stage.
Well, that would be right. So you stick the juniper in the alcohol and then you can argue that it is a health drink.
Absolutely. No question about it. I think there's pretty much a decent amount of evidence. In fact, a couple of years ago, we had a post on our website, on our Facebook site, that told the story about how gin was good at as a treatment for hay fever. And it went crazy. And we had something like 500,000 hits on that one.
And what people saying, yeah, that's my experience, or I'm rushing out to drink gin now for my hay fever?
Yeah, most of them were saying, well, that's another good reason to drink it.
I've got a bit of a sniffle right now. Gin, please. All right. So I'm speaking with David Box, author of Australian Gin. He is the founder of Gin Tonica. So the English called it Geneva, apparently. Why is that?
Well, the history that really comes about of the spirit we know today rather than the medicine, there's a few stories of certain people, but a lot of it's been debunked. And but Geneva with a J was a Dutch spirit that certainly was considered at some stages as healthy for you. It had a distinctive flavour, and that became known as Geneva with a G. So there is a little bit of difference in pronunciation, but I won't bother about it now. Can't get my tongue around it with a G and T in hand. But Geneva was then shortened to gin eventually. But it all came about, Suzanne, when the English were fighting the Dutch against Spain.
All right. And so how was that? The Dutch introduced it to the English?
Yeah. So around the 16th century, you've heard, people have heard the expression Dutch courage. So that came about by the English soldiers. Actually, everyone, the generals would know, feed all these soldiers a hell of a lot of Geneva before they went into battle, and they fought unbelievably. Really, they didn't care. They just were happy.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So the Dutch courage is literally gin specifically. When you've got that courage, yeah, because you've had a couple, it's gin. Wow.
Well, you think about the young guys who go out in the evening, get really drunk, and you don't want to do too much misogynistic battering, but they get a lot of courage to go and talk to the girls and vice versa these days. But, they go out and fight a bit sometimes when they're drunk.
Oh, I have never heard of that. Yes.
No, exactly.
And then William of Orange steps in. What's his role in gin's story?
So there's a bit of a link in those eras, in that era, because William of Orange, he was Dutch in the royalty there and born in The Hague. And he married Mary, I think Mary the Second of England.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
That's it. And he died in Kensington Palace, and he took the throne of England and became William III. And he was an enemy of, we were, you know, at that stage, the Anglos, France and Spain, enemies. So he put, you know, taxed spirits. And that gave Geneva a massive boost.
So what were the spirits that would have come in from France and Spain that time that he sort of taxed out of popularity?
Well, certainly brandy, definitely out of France. But you're also looking at sherry from Spain. There's spirits, similar spirits out of Spain. But, so he didn't only just put tax on spirits, but he also put tax on beer. So he became quite popular for the Dutch exporters.
And thus the English turned to gin in a very big way.
Yeah, that was really the big difference. So, so we can definitely thank William of Orange on that front.
Isn't this interesting? I mean, and we've talked now about vodka, we've talked about rum, and what we discovered when we talked about rum was that rum stopped being the American choice of drink in favour of whiskey, basically because of politics. And here we have another, you know, world leader making a policy that ends up sending the English taste for liquor in a certain direction that's basically stayed there. That's fascinating.
It gets more fascinating as you go on, because politics has played a part right through to the current time in Australia. That's jumping ahead a bit. It's been crazy right into the 18th century gin craze. You've heard the term Mother's Ruin?
I have indeed. That's where we were going next. So yeah, tell me what happened. How did gin get that reputation?
Well, there's a lot of, again, it's difficult to pick the true stories, but it seems pretty fair that a lot of the botanicals, apart from just juniper that would go into gin, they would often cover up the nasty taste of the badly distilled product. You might hear sometimes that methanol can make you go blind. So if you're distilling ethanol, sister alcohol, and you've got too much methanol in there, it's not good for you. But they weren't great at distillation. So a lot of the bad stories of Mother's Ruin probably comes from the bad distillation, because there was a still in every street at one stage.
Oh, wow. All right. So basically you distill some garbage alcohol and then you cover it up with juniper and everyone thinks they're drinking gin but still gets sick or feels terrible.
Yeah, that's right. And the same thing happened a lot later with bathtub gin, but that's another story again. But it was that period, Suzanne, that the politics started to get very interesting, because you ever seen Hogarth's, there's a painting, I think it's Gin Lane and Beer Street.
I might have seen one of them, but no, tell us more about it.
So Hogarth, it's a really popular image that goes up to explain gin and how terrible it was, and it has a woman with a baby in her arms, drunk, baby's falling out, the whole street looks terrible. And there is a second pairing of that picture with Beer Street, with happy people, and it was actually Hogarth was a good propagandist for the breweries. He was paid to do that.
Oh, you're kidding.
At that stage, gin was overwhelming the sales of beer, and they really needed to fight back.
Wow. All right. So how long did it take for gin to recover from that bad reputation that it developed?
Oh, look, the government of the day were very worried about what was happening, and they weren't getting the taxes and the same old story. And they tried a few times during the mid-18th to mid-19th century to put different bans or taxes. It was never really easy to do that. And one of the reasons is people really wanted to survive.
So what about cocktails and gin, David? When did gin sort of become, you know, very upper class and people started mixing their cocktails with it?
Well, if I can jump back just a little bit, because there was an issue in London when it was getting very big, and alcohol, as I mentioned about being a biocide, London was the biggest city in the world and there were rat-infested places, the Thames was a sewer, and people were, you know, dying of dysentery, so better to get blind drunk than to die of dysentery. And that era created such a negative attitude to gin that it was many, many decades later that, and with the improvement of distillation, that gin became a clean spirit. And then cocktails started to come about. And when it got cleaner and got a better reputation in the late 19th century, it became the basis for most good cocktails.
So you mentioned there were usually stills on every street during that period in mm-hmm. London. Were there also professional people making gin companies?
One of the oldest distilleries is Tanqueray's, which is a very basic gin, not one of my favourites personally, but... that was the 1830s. So there were distilleries setting up and they did become professional. But, you know, it took many, many decades before the cheap neighbourhood distillery would have to shut up shop because the professional guys got better at it.
So do we know what the first kind of cocktails were, David? What were people mixing with or experimenting with first when it came to gin?
I think then in the cocktail game, there's a few famous cocktail books. So I've just slipped them from my mind. I think it was Harry's Bar in New York. But there was a basis of a lot of cocktails that became popular. And, of course, the martini was one of the early ones.
Yep. What followed the martini? What are the others? Well, gin and tonic, how long's that one been around?
Well, a lot of people don't even class that as a cocktail, which I think is terrible. It's It is, if it was officially called a cocktail, it would be the most popular in the world. But there's a few pop that they come into fashion and then they go away. The current high riding fashion for gin cocktails is the Negroni.
Yeah. So now, what's in a Negroni? How's that made?
So it's equal parts sweet vermouth, Amaro, which is bitter. There is a internationally known brand which I'll have to use. I love Australian products, but Campari is that word, and gin. So equal quantities, and it was supposedly invented by Count Negroni in Italy, who used to drink Americanos, which is vermouth and Amaro, and added gin one day.
So you were just saying, oh, sorry, David, you finish.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering about that definition of a cocktail. If you're saying that some people don't see a G&T as a cocktail, I mean, what is the definition? Are you clear on it?
Look, I'm clear on it. I don't know why the exception is made all the time, but there's some really important publications and online trends about what's happening in the cocktail world, and for some reason they just get omitted. I mean, you can have a whiskey and dry ginger, and that has got a cocktail name, but you know, why not a G&T? It's sacrilege.
But is it? I mean, do you know? Is it meant to be? You mix a spirit and one other ingredient, or two other ingredients?
No, look, there's a lot that are two ingredients, so two or three. It just beggars explanation, really.
It's just a bias sort of against G&T, basically.
I think so. There needs to be a movement against that.
You know, I think I know someone who should run that, David. That would be you. So what happened during Prohibition in the US? How did that affect gin production?
Look, that's obviously it hit the alcohol industry pretty hard, but there were a lot of speakeasies opened at the time, which is a term used for secret bars, and even now in most of our cities there are a multitude of speakeasy places, everything from a place in Melbourne where you walk into what looks like a place that makes sandwiches and you go in the fridge and there's a bar behind there, or a place that makes pizzas and you go in there and there's a bar behind there.
Yeah, I went into one like that in Edinburgh last year, and it's a barbershop. You walk in, and then you end up in a bar. Yeah.
And there's one in Sydney, the same thing. But the prohibition was very interesting. That it's one of the reasons that Al Capone got his foot in the door there in Chicago, and he used to just buy very, very fast cars. He'd pop next door into Canada. And one of the biggest companies in the world at some stage was Seagram's. And Mr. Seagram used to make gin in his garage, and Al Capone would use fast cars to outrun the police.
Did the quality suffer during that era if they were going back to gin that was being produced in garages and, you know, illegal stills?
Yeah, that's where the term earlier bathtub gin comes from. So there'd be all these illegal stills making moonshine or other spirits, and if you wanted to make gin, you just got the moonshine, throw it in a bath, throw in some juniper, coriander, a few spices and everything, and bingo, a form of gin.
Wow. All right, I'm glad we don't have to drink that anymore. Now, when did we start falling in love with gin in Australia? Were we drinking it back in the early days of colonial settlement or not?
Oh, certainly was. There's in my book, I go into a lot of people know about the world history of gin, but the Australian history isn't amazing as well. There's going back to, I think it was the third fleet, actually, a guy called James Underwood came over, and he ended up being a major player in that area of the first gin distilleries.
So why was it illegal until the 90s to operate a craft distillery in Australia?
Politics. It was all about tax, and to control the government getting taxes, a lot of the time the Australian tax, or back then the excise officers of the colonies, would actually have someone sitting with the stills, making sure that no one had any pipes going out the back and missing out on their taxes. And you couldn't really have people in every still, so they made a law that the stills had to be fairly large so they could, you know, justify having people there all the time. And I'm sure they took bribes. But it ended up that you needed to have a still of about 2,700 litres to actually legally operate. And to put that in perspective, everyone might know Four Pillars, who have been successful all around the world, and certainly, you know, they've paved the way. And today, all of their stills don't add up to 2,700 litres.
Wow. Okay. So you can only really be making it if you're doing it at scale. So did we have people in Australia making it at scale?
Yeah, we did. We had, in fact, Corio Distillery in Geelong was at one stage the biggest distillery in the Southern Hemisphere and one of the biggest in the world, making Corio whiskey, and I think Vickers was made there. And we had a distillery in Moorabbin here in Victoria. But, yeah, Victoria had some of the largest distilleries and a lot of exports around the world.
Wow, isn't that fascinating? All right. So
and it got,
go on.
It got killed by government legislation again.
All right, so what happened then?
So basically it was a gentleman, often known as the grandfather of whiskey, Bill Lark. In 1992, he got together with various politicians, including Barry Jones, a very, very well-known man.
Pick a box, indeed. And
that's right. So at that stage, the 1901 Distillation Act had been virtually unamended, and Bill wanted to make single malt whiskey, and his still could sit on the family kitchen table. And so when he found out that he couldn't do it unless he had some monster still, they got together, they lobbied the government, and they basically took away that minimum.
And that was sort of the floodgates opening, was it?
It was the beginning. It was very quiet, but Bill and his wife Lynn made the first single malt whiskey in 154 years.
Oh, wow.
In Hobart. And, in fact, last year, Bill became only the 28th inductee into the World Whiskey Awards Hall of Fame and the first Australian to be honoured that way.
Yeah. And so what about gin then? If Bill started making whiskey, were there people who then said, OK, we'll start making gin then?
Well, Lynn, his wife, was one of the earliest, and there was a couple of other people who could be considered the first to make modern Australian gin. But I think we've got a count of all people, Bill's brother, John. He started Kangaroo Island Spirits as the first dedicated Australian large distillery on Kangaroo Island in about 2006.
So so now we're up to, you reckon, 1,500?
Yeah, for different gins, yes. Distilleries sort of took off. In 2010, including John, there's probably only 12 small craft distilleries. I think that was about the size of the Australian Distillers Association back then when it was founded. But by about 2017, there were 50. And then by 2019, about 200. And about three quarters of those were making gin. And last year, definitely well over 500, possibly 600 distilleries now, most making gin.
So is it feasible when you have a distillery, you can make any spirit, you can have one? What, is it done in barrels? I don't really know anything about the process.
That is a really good question. So you need a still. You've got the still, it becomes a distillery. And with gin, you're basically taking a spirit already. Some people make their own. To make alcohol, you need a carbohydrate, you ferment it, you get a wine or something like that, and then you take the alcohol out of that wine, or for whiskey, out of the grain, fermenting grain. So you need to get the alcohol first, and that comes from the still. With gin, you're adding botanicals in through the process. So if anyone can imagine a sort of a pot on the stove boiling away, and then there's an arm that comes over, and basically, to make it as simple as possible, you can the alcohol evaporates, comes up, boils away, and then you cool it on the way down and it condenses, and then you can take away the spirit from there. So that's in the really simplest terms.
Okay. So if you've got a distillery, though, so you can be, I'm making gin, I'm making whiskey. You don't have to dedicate yourself to making one in particular, by the sounds of
it. Well, the big change that happens is to be a whiskey, it must be aged in barrels for a couple of years. And the same thing with rum. To be called a rum, it's got to be aged. So the easiest thing, you can make a gin and some people will sell it the next day. But if it once it's stabilized a bit, a week or a month, you can sell it straight away. So it becomes a really important cash flow to start making money from a distillery before all your aged spirits have reached their maturity.
Aha! Fascinating. I had no idea about any of that. Amazing. And so do we have, as well as the craft distillers, are there big companies also distilling gin, creating gin at scale today?
Look, there are. There's some old stills sitting around that were making brandy, which was used a lot for making port. So you make the spirit and you fortify a wine. Fortifying it basically means to add some alcohol. So there are some very large stills. You've still got, I think it's St. Agnes brandy. So that, they were the big stills, and some of them have been converted. The smaller ones have been converted into gin. But generally, gin's made at the smaller scales. And even at this stage, the famous Bill Lark's distillery wouldn't be still wouldn't be more than 500 or 600 litres. So for big companies to make it, they really need to make it at scale for export these days.
Are we exporting our gin overseas and doing so successfully then?
Some are, but again, we have a little political problem in that regard.
Pollies keep getting involved in this, don't they?
Don't they? In everything we do when it comes to things that bring taxes. So sadly, and this is where we get a little bit of politics, if it's okay, Suzanne.
Go on.
We have about the second or third heaviest taxes on spirits in the world.
Okay.
Have you got off the ground?
Well, I think I might have heard that. Now, is that because it's basically a sin tax to encourage us not to drink the spirits because it's bad for us when we have too much?
Geez, that's a question that's, you know, that's as long as your arm. The spirits is no different in the same alcohol in beer, the same alcohol in cider or wine. Why spirits should be quite different? I think it goes back to the fact that it's easily taxed, it's easily controlled. But at the end of the day, it just recently passed the level of $100 per litre of alcohol is the tax, the excise on spirits.
Wow.
Now, that equates, if you've got a 40% gin and some of the lovely ones are 44, 45%, $35 or more of that bottle is, of cost is going to the government.
And does that apply regardless of whether it's sold domestically or it's exported?
If it's exported, you get an export. You can export it tax-free from excise-free. Every decent business needs to have a solid home base to build upon. You need a good, solid local market. And then from that, you can invest in export. But if you're throttled by heavy taxes and that limits the way things go, then it becomes difficult. And the same way the wine industry was given encouragement, it's time that our extremely good spirits are given a bit of a go overseas.
If where would the overseas markets be where our gin producers would be most likely to find a receptive drinking audience?
Oh, look, it's the big gin drinkers are in Europe. A lot of people don't realise that the Spanish, for example, drink more gin per capita than the English, French and Americans combined.
You're kidding, really?
Now, that's where the name Gin Tonica came from because I was sitting in a bar in San Sebastian, thinking there's no money in wine. I love gin. Why don't I do something in that? And Gin Tonica, which is a Spanish name for a gin and tonic, Gin Tonic, that's where it was born. But Spain is a tougher market. But certainly I went to a gin show in London in about 2019. And the biggest amount of gin by any other country apart from England was Australia.
Wow. You've written the book, Australian Gin. I know you're actually wanting to make sure that you've got all of the gin distilleries covered. So you're in fact calling out if anyone has a gin distillery that they know that you don't know about, you want to hear from them, right?
Yeah, I've got a list of about 600, and I'm very shortly be publishing Gin Tonic, A Guide to Australian Gin. And it's time with so many distilleries, so many gins, that we really need to give a guide to people as to what the best distilleries are and who's producing the best gin. So we've got a group of gin tasting panels, and we'll be with Gin Tonica, we've bottled in Gin Tonica over 400 different Australian gins into small bottles, 30 and 50 mils. So we'll just shoot those out to a fair amount of the judges out there, a tasting team, and we'll start helping people to head to the right quality. And hopefully that in itself will guide people to companies who produce good gin, help them to get bigger and export.
Yeah. So I understand that, for example, at the Australian Distilled Spirits Awards, the panel had to taste and judge 90 gins in 2 days. Do you have to spit out like you do into the wine spittoon? Is it the same process?
It is. It is. You can't. It gets very tricky. If it's a really not particularly great gin, it's pretty easy to get rid of it quickly. if it's a really good gin, there is no choice. You're only having a small amount in neat. That's how you judge it, and you can extrapolate from that. But you've really separate the gold from the trophies. You just got to drink that, make sure it lasts long and it's complex. But, yeah, if you didn't spit and rinse and have a biscuit in between.
You'd all be on the floor, obviously. So, David, you were saying you need to judge whether it lasts. Is that like what are the hallmarks of a great gin?
Well, by definition, and this is where a bit of controversy comes in, you really need to have that juniper flavour somewhere in there. There's a lot of gins. Some of them are named gins, but to be a gin, it's got to actually, by law, be over 37% alcohol. And there are some gins that are more like gin liqueurs, very sweet, and some of them don't make it that high. There is a category called slow gin, S-L-O-E, and they're made from slows, and that's a category in itself. We have those in Australia. But there's a very good story, actually. There's a distillery in New South Wales called Brookies, Cape Byron Distillery, and they have a Brookies gin, and they created slow gin, S-L-O-W. And they put in there a Davidsonian plums, which is a bitter plum, like a slow is from Blackthorns. That's bitter. So it's an Australian equivalent. So they made a slow gin with the W, and it won awards in the UK. I'm not sure everyone was happy that it met the brief.
Aha. Uh-huh. Sounds like there's always some controversy in the world of gin, David.
It's good for the Aussies to challenge the Brits anytime.
Now, look, James says a well-made gin fizz, sour or ricky is hard to beat. So, there we go. All right. Well, I reckon I've got some gin in the cupboard, so I might mix one up, probably not when I get home, but when I'm free next week, see what I can come up with. Thank you so much, David, for joining us on Nightlife to tell us the story of gin tonight.
My pleasure, Suzanne. It's been great to talk about my passion. There's a lot of great Australian gins out there, so I encourage anyone to go and find what they love.
David, thank you again. That is David Box. David is the author of Australian Gin, and he is the founder of Gin Tonica.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.